for us this evening as we get into your word. And it's another couple of challenging chapters that dig into our hearts and our minds and how we so often are as human beings. And we're going to ask that you bring blessing to this time for us too. So as we settle our hearts in, settle our minds, and just all of these things, we don't want to forget about them. We just want to ask you by your Spirit to speak to our hearts. It's a lot right now, Lord. And grateful for who you are. Grateful that we can gather. Grateful for your provision. Would you continue it? In Jesus' name, please. Amen. I was going to mention from the video, our friend Kara, you saw the two ladies that were being interviewed on that balcony. That's in the city of Budapest. The one with clearly the younger gal, Ukrainian refugees, like she was saying, you know, our Calvary Chapel, or we used to have a Calvary Chapel in Ukraine. Obviously, she's a refugee, but the other lady with the yellow kind of top and the scarf, that's our friend Kara, and she served in Ukraine for 15 or 20 years or something crazy. And 20 years, and she, the last few years, just felt compelled of the Lord, like, I need to be in Hungary for some reason. And like 4 years ago, moved to Hungary, like, why am I here? I know the Lord wants me to be here. I don't know, but I believe He wants me here, and I speak Ukrainian. Why? And then fast forward, like, through COVID and everything else, and I think she mentioned in the video, like, I was able to get this bigger apartment. And if she had left when everyone left as a refugee, she would not have anything, let alone an apartment, let alone a bigger apartment. Now she's able to bring people into her apartment, like mattresses on the floor of her apartment, and to just talk with and pray with all these different people. So just the Lord's, even the sovereign timing of, let's put this person here, and I don't know why I'm here. I'd rather be back home in Ukraine. I need you here right now. And now she's seeing the fruit of her obedience. So many stories, and we're going to continue to do what we're doing with just staying in touch and getting funds out to those that are doing that work. Numbers chapter 16. That's my non-segue. Last week we went through like the first three verses because it was, you know, quite the conversation. So let's reread those first three verses. I'll make one more comment kind of connected to last week and then dig in a little bit more. Numbers chapter 16, verse 1. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, so you might pronounce it Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, the sons of Reuben, they took men. And verse 2, they rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation, men of renown, and they gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, you take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy, right? Anyone could do this. We're all holy. Anyone should do this. Every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord? And so we spent quite a bit of time talking about that last week, but just again, this comment, self-glory is right on the throne of Satan's heart. And this is about as satanic as you can get. Like, no, like, you know, sacrificing animals or whatever, like, this is about as satanic as you're going to get. Self-exaltation is really the very heart of Satan. It's a whole other conversation, but here they are. So this is what's happening. If you missed it last week, spend some time on that if you'd like. And so we read this, verse 4. So when Moses heard it, he fell on his face. And I really love Moses' response here. And we'll listen to what he says in just a second. But some commentators have kind of, I'll use this word and I'll use it again later tonight, speculated. I think it's a healthy word because all it says, he fell on his face. Typically, biblically, that's associated with worship. Typically, it's associated, of course, with humility. Typically, it's associated with even with prayer. So a lot of commentators have suggested, like, he probably took this moment and just prayed, Lord, what would you have me to do with this? These 250 men with this little group together, what am I meant to do? So this is how he responds, verse 5. And he spoke to Korah and all his company, saying, tomorrow morning the Lord will show who is his and who is holy, right? They had said, everybody's holy. And what does holy mean? To be set apart, to be appointed to something specific. We'll see who that is, and we'll cause him to come near to him. that one whom he chooses, he will cause to come near to him. In other words, let's just see tomorrow what God's opinion is of all this. Thank you, gentlemen, for your input here, but I wonder if God has an opinion. No, I think he does. So why don't we do this? Verse 6, take censers, Korah and all your company, censers, or these would be like a fire pan or an incense, like a small vessel that you could carry incense. So take these, Korah, and all your company. And this is where Moses actually, if you're reading it right now, he begins to lay into these men. He just gets after it here. Verse 7, put fire in them and put incense in them before the Lord tomorrow, and it shall be that the man whom the Lord chooses is the Holy One. You take too much upon yourselves, you sons of Levi. Like Moses, Aaron, you take too much on yourself. You take too much on yourself. Like he's getting after it here, as we'll see as we move along. Then Moses, verse 8, said to Korah, hear now, you sons of Levi. It is a small thing to you. Like this is not a great thing that you do, or in their mind, it's no big deal. It's a small thing to you that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself to do the work of the tabernacle of the Lord and to stand before the congregation to serve them. You guys don't think this is that big of a deal? And verse 10, that he has brought you near to himself, you and all your brethren, the sons of Levi, with you. You guys think this is no big deal? And are you seeking, notice this in verse 10, are you seeking the priesthood also? Notice what's happening here. For those, not just here in this instance, but as a general statement, for those like Korah that would challenge leadership in this capacity, because again, we see that in verse 3 clearly, they spoke against Moses and Aaron, right? We talked about this last week, that of course, Moses, what was, do you remember his response when the Lord called him? How about my brother? Like, can you send my... It wasn't like Moses was going out of his way to have this happen. So those like Korah, it's not enough to just be in any position. They crave the authority. And I might even take the word crave, and in this instance, what's happening here in chapter 16, I might drop the word crave and put demand. They demand the authority. It's again a don't you know who we are kind of thing. And did you notice what it said there in verse 10? Are you seeking, at the end of the verse, are you seeking the priesthood also? Well, look at it in context. Verse 1, Korah the son of Itzar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, the son of Levi, which meant he was part of the tribe, obviously, of Levi, and the Levites were the priestly tribe. So what does he mean? You're seeking the priesthood, no doubt, as we'll see here just a little bit more clearly in a moment. It seems like he was going after Aaron's role as that of the high priest. Some irony here is simple. This man and these men were seeking this and these spiritual positions using carnal, fleshly, sinful, selfish, and self-centered means. I'd like to do the priestly stuff. I'd like to do those holy things for God. And I mean, fine, if I get recognized, that's good too, but I just want to do these holy things, and I'll do as many cutthroat things as I have to do to get myself into that position. Yikes. And again, aren't you glad, please notice my sarcasm here, that none of those things happen today. Essentially, like if Korah has a playbook for this, the playbook would include accusation, intimidation, gathering a following for himself against Moses and Aaron, in other words, against God's anointed servants, and as we're going to ultimately see in just a moment, this is all against God. It's a bit of a side note here as well, but usually this type of self-appointed leader is actually doing this for standing or position. He's doing this for notoriety or prominence. He's doing this for authority or power. He's doing this to make a name for himself or to have a title. And so it's a bit of a side note, but I think it's worth mentioning, because when you get to the New Testament, you get this great passage in 1 Timothy chapter 3. If you're familiar with the passage, you know that 1 Timothy chapter 3 says that if a man desires the position of a bishop, or an overseer, it says there, 1 Timothy 3:1, that he desires a good work. And so there's three really important words with that verse. 1 Timothy 3:1, if he desires this position, this title, he desires, same word, a good work. And so it's not that he covets this, but he desires that. He wants to do this. So the position of a bishop or the overseer would be this office or this role. He wants to be in a position to be able to do that and to desire what? He desires a good work. If it's just to get a plaque on his door, he's automatically disqualified. So the person who wants the work, doesn't really care about the notoriety, is really a prime candidate for spiritual service. Again, unfortunately, I see so many who just want the recognition. They want to be seen as a somebody who is so important. That was Korah. I'll just throw this out as a kind of a general side note to the side note to the side note here. I'm keeping track of my own side notes, don't worry. But look out for name droppers who insist upon being recognized with all those who they believe to be important people. They know the big names, right? So they want to make sure that they're connected to that. They're not necessarily looking for the work. They just really want, again, the title. Proverbs 28:25. This is the side reference to the side note, to the side note, to the side note. Proverbs 28:25. He who is of a proud heart stirs up strife, but he who trusts in the Lord will be prospered. And that's so often the case, and it's biblical. A proud-hearted person stirs up strife because they're trying to make a name for themselves. At any rate, without sounding weird here, the spirit of Korah is alive and well today. And the spirit of Korah, if you will, kind of that vibe, that mindset, that attitude, is alive and well today in today's church, unfortunately. So back to the text. Therefore, verse 11, you and all your company, this is Moses speaking to them, you and all your company are gathered together, here it is, against the Lord. Oh, we were just making some comments. You know, we just asked some questions, Moses and Aaron. It seems like you're taking too much upon yourselves. And isn't everybody holy? Why would it just be you? We're just asking some questions. No, this is against the Lord. You are gathered in one heart, one mind against the Lord. And I love this. He says, and what is Aaron that you complain against him? Like, why are you picking on Aaron at this point? You know, what did Aaron do to you, kind of thing? And then Moses, verse 12, he sent to call Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab. We read about them in verse 1. But they said, we will not come up. Like, no, we're not going to acknowledge your authority there, Moses. Is it a small thing, and this is them speaking to Moses, is it a small thing that you have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness, that you should keep acting like a, notice this little cutting remark, act like a prince over us? What was Moses in Egypt? Prince. Moreover, verse 14, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor given us inheritance of fields and vineyards. Will you put out the eyes of these men? We will not come up. Quite a bit in this. These seem to be these lingering complaints about all this kind of stuff. You know, are we just meant to die in the wilderness? And who do you think you are? These lingering complaints. Maybe it's a stretch, and again, I'm going to use this word specifically, certainly some measure of speculation on my part here, but did the people get these kind of complaints from their leaders? It's entirely possible. Maybe these people have just been kind of running their mouths for far too long and the people kind of ate it up. Or is it this? Did the leaders do too much, follow me here with this, did they do too much listening to the complaints of the people and not enough for leading the people on the basis of faith? Like, you got to stop with the complaints, smaller group of people. You got to stop it. Clearly the Lord delivered us from the hand of Egypt. Clearly by His strong hand, He got us through the Red Sea. Clearly, and they should have been leading in that capacity. But again, even these little subtle and not so subtle digs, you keep acting like a prince over us. This just is evidence that they have zero respect, zero room to acknowledge any growth in Moses. In their eyes, there's zero grace for Moses. And did you catch this other little? I mean, there's so much to these complaints. Did you catch this? Notice what they say in verse 13. Is it a small thing, is it no big deal, Moses, that you have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey? What are they describing? Egypt. Egypt was the land flowing with milk and honey. I'm like, okay, let me do some math here. It seems like carry the one. It seems like back in all those years in Egypt, they were slaves. But it was flowing with milk and honey. I mean, talk about unbelief. We'd rather have, our slavery was so great, and you just brought us out here in the wilderness. And notice further what they say in verse 14. Moreover, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey. Wasn't that the reason that the Lord sent those spies in, just a couple chapters ago? Like, let's go find out what it is. Are we ready to go? Let's go check it out. And what was the report? It's a land flowing with milk and honey. They were ready, and Moses was ready to lead them into this land flowing with milk and honey, but the people said, but there's giants, right? People are strong, cities are fortified, and there's giants in the land, so we can't go. So this wasn't on Moses, but they're now honoring their slave past and complaining about their own decisions of unbelief and blaming it on Moses. Like, this is just so twisted. And aren't you glad that people never get twisted in their minds, and this never like works in their theology or their attitudes at church? Whew. The Old Testament's got nothing for... Are you kidding me? Like, pretty relevant. Verse 15, as you could imagine, then Moses was not just angry, but very angry, and he said to the Lord, if you're going to complain, complain up, right? Talk to the Lord about these things. He was very angry, and he said to the Lord, do not respect their offering. I have not taken one donkey from them, nor have I hurt one of them. I've done nothing to wrong them. I've robbed them in no way. And Moses said to Korah, now turns his attention to him, tomorrow you and all your company be present before the Lord, you and they, as well as Aaron. And this is what you're to do, verse 17. Let each take his censer and put incense in it. Each of you bring his censer before the Lord, 250 censers, both you and Aaron, each with his censer. So again, he's putting it to the test. He's telling them, this is what we're going to do. Again, we're going to see what the Lord's opinion might be on this. But imagine being Moses or Aaron in this situation. You know, put yourself in their shoes or their sandals. Talk about bold. It's like you and your brother against this mob of people that essentially want you dead, right? And Moses' confidence was, but the Lord asked me to do this. Thus, I'm confident that the will of the Lord will be done. Pretty fascinating how this works. And it's really fascinating, especially how you see this all come together. God was the one, and God is the one who gets to decide, who got to decide who was the person to lead. It was not based on popular opinion. If it were based on popular opinion, Moses would have been out a long time ago. It's not that. It's a side note to... Well, this is still just one side note. Yeah, it's still one side note. This is a terrible... That would be a terrible way to conduct church business. Popular opinion? Yeah, have you ever read... Sarcasm here again, kind of. But have you ever read 1 and 2 Corinthians? Those are believers, right? He's writing to the church, the saints, the holy ones in Corinth. And man, if they voted on things in church, I would not like to see the outcome of those types of votes, right? So this is not about popular opinion. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to bring these censers. Verse 18, this is what happened. So every man took his censer, put fire in it, laid incense on it, and stood at the door of the tabernacle of meeting with Moses and Aaron. And Korah gathered all the congregation against them at the door of the tabernacle meeting. And then, here it is, and then the glory of the Lord appeared to all the congregation. And the Lord now answers them. Verse 20. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, I love this, verse 21, separate yourselves from among this congregation. Why? That I may consume them in a moment. This is basically a divine, y'all might want to stand back a little bit here because it's about to get real ugly real quick, or I don't know if it's a heavenly, could someone please hold this for a second because I'm about to bring it on this whole congregation. That's just how I see it. And then, verse 22, they fell on their faces and said, O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin and you be angry with all the congregation? Like, is that really how it should be? So the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the congregation, saying, get away from the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And then Moses arose and went to Dathan and Abiram, and the elders of Israel, notice that in verse 25, the elders of Israel followed him. We'll come back to that. And he spoke to the congregation, saying, depart now from the tents of these wicked men. Touch nothing of theirs. In other words, don't be connected to anything that's theirs, lest you be consumed in all their sins. So they got away from around the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the door of their tents with their wives, their sons, and their little children. And Moses said, verse 28, by this you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works, for I have not done them of my own will. If these men die naturally like all men, or if they are visited by the common fate of all men, you know, if they just kind of die, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord creates a new thing, and the earth opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that belongs to them, and they go down alive into the pit, then you will understand that these men have rejected the Lord. That's pretty specific. Like, a piano fell on them, so is that really? Like, no, this is what I'm saying. This is how we're going to know. So, again, several things about this little section. Moses is offering a sign, a miraculous sign to be proof. And this sign would be unmistakable. It's not like, well, the earth kind of swallowed them up, but not really. No, this is... But the idea here with this sign, with this miracle, wasn't for Moses to get something. It wasn't, God, show me a sign and then I'll believe. This was not about so Moses could start believing, but to reveal the truth of his call. Would you make this apparent? Who's who to everybody here, Lord? Thus, again, verse 28, he did not call himself to this, and just talked about that a moment ago, definitely talked about it last week. He didn't sign up for it. And notice also, as I mentioned in verse 25, I'd come back to it, the elders followed. Those are the guys from chapter 10 that are listed. Those were true leaders that were willing, even during difficulties like this, greatly outnumbered, but they were willing to stand with the Lord and whom the Lord had chosen to lead. Also notice, this stands out to me in verse 26, depart from the tents of these wicked men. Remember what they said at the beginning of the chapter? Everybody here is holy. Everybody in the camp is holy. Who do you think you are, Moses and Aaron, that you should be the ones? You take too much on yourself. Everyone's holy. He's not saying that, well, they're not holy. He's also not saying that they're not holy. He's not even saying unholy. The Holy Spirit's assessment of these men in this situation? No, actually, they're wicked. Oh. This isn't like, you know, it's not that bad. No, it's actually wickedness. Whoa. Korah's goal was not to glorify God, but to glorify self. Wicked. As I mentioned, I don't know, 10 minutes ago, this is perhaps the most satanic of all ambition. So Moses is saying, look, if the earth swallows them up, this will be a brand new thing, like no one's ever seen it before. If something like a valley of quicksand, like how would you describe this? If that happens, God has answered against them. So let's just see what might happen. I'm just throwing that out there. This is what I think the Lord's going to do. Now it came to pass, verse 31, as he finished speaking all these words, it's like the moment he stopped speaking, that the ground split apart under them, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with their households and all the men with Korah with all their goods. And so they and all those with them went down alive into the pit. The earth closed over them and they perished from among the assembly. This is terrible, but I have two words in my notes here. This is an instant funeral. I'm sorry, I can't help, but it's kind of like, if this happens, and then we'll see, and then boom. But everybody, and even, you know, the family, they were all connected to it. It seemed like prior to this, it was get away from their tents, right? Don't be connected to them. People could have said, no, I'm backing off from that. They didn't. And then verse 34, as you can imagine, then all Israel who were around them fled at their cry, for they said, lest the earth swallow us up also. I mean, fear, yeah, they had said so many similar things against Moses leading up to this. So, and they had griped about their deliverance as well. And so there's this definite and obvious fear. And that's another side note too, isn't it? Like even in the New Testament, when you see Jesus perform miracles, how often do you find people, it sounds so wrong, especially on this side of the cross, but read the Gospels kind of casually, and people were often afraid of Jesus. Like, who is this person that can just calm the storms? They were afraid. Who does this kind of stuff? Intimidated. They were intimidated. Of course they were. And a fire, verse 35, came out from the Lord. Remember, the Lord's presence was there and consumed the 250 men who were offering incense. You can turn there if you'd like, but Proverbs chapter 6 has something to say about this. Proverbs chapter 6, if you're a note taker and just want to jot it down, read it later. Proverbs 6, verses 16 through 19 says this. These six things the Lord hates. Yes, seven are an abomination to him. A proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that are swift in running to evil, a false witness who speaks lies, and one who sows discord among the brethren. Well, you don't know. Earlier in the chapter here, chapter 16 of Numbers, this is wickedness. And God hates that? He hates, really? Because of what it's doing against him, against his character. He leaves no room for any of this, neither should we. Well, back here in Numbers, chapter 16, again, this fire comes out and consumes them. Verse 36 says, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, tell Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, to pick up the censers out of the blaze, like the blaze of 250 dead bodies on the ground. Like, just go through there, pick up those out of the blaze, for they are holy, the censers, these fire pans, these incense holders, and scatter the fire some distance away. With its strange fire, let's remove that from the camp. The censers of these men who sinned against their own souls, that's how that works, by the way, let them be made into hammered plates as a covering for the altar, because they presented them before the Lord, therefore they are holy. And they shall be a sign to the children of Israel. Interesting. Remove the strange fire, collect all 250 of those fire pans that are left behind. They were all, and all 250 of those people, they were all behind this. They were all in on this. They all supported Korah in this. And again, I talked about this last week. Every rebellion needs a leader, and every leader needs a follower. So they all go down. And then he says that you're going to craft this into this covering for the altar. It would be, again, a sign to them, a reminder to them, maybe just simply, let's not do that again, right? Very obvious. And so, verse 39, Eleazar the priest took the bronze censers with those who were burned, which those who were burned up had presented, and they were hammered out as a covering on the altar to be a memorial to the children of Israel, that no outsider who is not a descendant of Aaron should come near to offer incense before the Lord, that he might not become like Korah and his companions, just as the Lord had said to him through Moses. I like that. Let's not be like Korah and company. Like, oh, okay. And now, once again, here we are, and now everything will be both fine and also dandy, right? Like, this is where Jake was laughing last week, because of the next chapter, then, after the people complained, then everything's just great, right? The next section? It's not even like a month later. Verse 41, on the next day.
Sheesh.
On the next day, all the congregation, like 3 months later, a few people, that's not it. The next day, all the congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, saying, listen to this complaint. You have killed the people of the Lord. Like, Moses, dude, you made it so the earth just swallowed people alive. And then the fire from the Lord, you made it so the fire from the Lord just burned up 250 of our leaders. I mean, their ability to remember key details was, well, probably a lot like mine. Like, what did you have for breakfast yesterday kind of thing. I would think you'd remember the events that just happened the prior day, but ultimately, what's the complaint here? It's Moses, you killed God's people. This is on you, sir. Verse 42, now it happened when the congregation had gathered against Moses and Aaron that they turned toward the tabernacle of meeting, and suddenly, here it is again, the cloud covered it and the glory of the Lord appeared. Again, it's not like God's far off and not aware of all these things, and so this physical manifestation of his presence as these people are gathering against Moses and Aaron. And the Lord spoke to, or verse 43, then Moses and Aaron came before the tabernacle meeting, and the Lord spoke to Moses saying, just 1 second, we'll look at this. It's hard to fathom, especially, it's text, right? It's text on, it's black and white. It's text on a page. It's hard to fathom the emotion, but I think we can probably guess. If you were Moses and Aaron, and the next day, how would you be feeling about all of this? What's the old saying? If you want people to like you, sell ice cream, but don't become a leader. That's just 100% true. Moses and Aaron weren't in this to be liked. They weren't doing this so that they could have friends. It wasn't about this at all. And kind of the lack of reverence that the people have, again, it's against the Lord and who He has chosen and what He's chosen to do. They turn, it says here, towards the tabernacle of meeting, and the cloud that's covering it, physical manifestation of God's presence. Moses and Aaron, they come before the tabernacle meeting, and again, verse 44, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, get away from among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment. And they fell, like, we've just read all this, right? And they fell on their faces, just like the previous day, smoke kind of still lingering in the distance. Take that strange fire over there. Like, smoke's got to still be lingering, you know. Fell on their faces. I like how Pastor David Guzik says this. They understood that it was no small thing to sympathize with a divisive, contentious person. God takes it seriously, and so should we, end quote. Why did you kill the people of God? Let's not talk about how they wanted to, you know, essentially kill you, overthrow you. They were doing this against the Lord, and they were making all these wild accusations, etc., etc., but it's just not fair that the Lord would do that. Apparently the Lord thought that was exactly the right thing to do. And notice what they do as the Lord again says, just can you back up a second because I'm going to consume them in a moment. They fell on their faces. And Moses then said to Aaron, take a censer and put fire in it from the altar, put incense on it, and take it quickly to the congregation and make atonement for them. For wrath has gone out from the Lord. The plague has begun, whatever exactly that was. And then Aaron took it as Moses commanded and ran into the midst of the assembly. And already the plague had begun among the people, so he put in the incense and made atonement for the people. And he stood between the dead and the living, and so the plague was stopped. And now those who died in the plague were 14,700, besides those who died in the Korah incident, as it'll be commemorated. And so Aaron returned to Moses at the door of the tabernacle of meeting, for the plague had stopped. What's interesting to me about it, just right off the bat there in verse 46, so Moses said to Aaron, we need to do that based on what? Based on what the Lord said in verse 45. In a moment, this is going to happen. It's simple, but it's kind of an obvious thing. They believed what God said, and they acted accordingly. I think it's just a great little nugget of a reminder. This is what God said, so we should do something based on that. And how did they act? Apparently, in love. They didn't say, finally, take it away, Lord. They could have just stepped back and let the Lord do His thing, but they acted in such a manner that they tried to help, and they tried to help people. And it's kind of a segue or a side note with all this, you know, with what's happening in the world. This is where there's a lot of other discussions. There's a lot of good discussions and even good arguments that could be made. There's a lot of political conversations about what's happening in the world, specifically Ukraine right now. But for me and my heart, what we need to be doing is like, how can we help people? I'm not the president, I'm not the vice president, I don't do any of those other things, but what can we do for people? I'm not slighting anyone that's doing this right now, because I've thought the same thing, and I know I've had this conversation with some people just in the last couple of weeks. Yeah, but what about like the Ezekiel stuff with Gog and Magog? We'll get to that when we get to that. I don't know that the outset of a war is where we should take a couple of weeks and just dive into that and unnecessarily speculate on how that, because it's all going to go down. We know that. But right now, like, there's actual people. A woman's hospital was bombed. I think that takes precedence. You're not hearing me say that takes precedence over prophecy, but I am saying people take precedence in the heart of God. So Moses and Aaron here, they're looking at what can we do to stand in the gap, if you will, great Christianese, stand in the gap for people, rather than them saying, well, actually, obviously, it's their fault. This is their problem. Or how do we like to say it today? It's not my zoo, not my monkeys, right? Like, that's on them, so that's all we're going to do. No, Aaron, go and run, go get that, and let's do what we can while we can. It's actually a wonderful picture of intercession, taking care of people. They're so undeserving. Yeah, as though we're somehow deserving of God's love, and we don't deserve any of it. I'm so glad that someone invited me to church at some point, someone that I heard about Jesus. You know, it's that kind of thing. By the way, it's a great picture of another thing. Again, here's David Guzik. Most importantly, Aaron the high priest's work here is a picture of our high priest Jesus and his work on our behalf. We were guilty sinners deserving judgment. We were rightly plagued. Our Savior was sent on His mission. He was unjustly accused and attacked. He prayed on our behalf. He ran to save us. He stood between death and life for us. And He is the only chance for salvation, being the dividing line between death and life. Amen and amen. Chapter 17 is a short chapter. Are you guys okay? You want to dig into chapter 17? We'll do questions after, Mike. I know there's good stuff, but are you guys okay to just quickly hit short chapter? Even if you said no, I was going to do it. I'm just, no. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children." Like, if one person said, "Yeah, we're good," like, then that's it. So speak to the children of Israel and get from them a rod from each father's house, all their leaders according to their father's houses, 12 rods. Write each man's name on his rods, and this is obviously connected to the last section, or it will be obvious. And you shall write Aaron's name on the rod of Levi, for there shall be one rod for the head of each father's house. And then, verse 4, you shall place them in the tabernacle of meeting before the testimony where I will meet with you. So these rods, this would be kind of a staff, and this had somehow morphed into some kind of symbolic article that these leaders would have carried, you know, kind of a staff, this rod that they would have had. So a symbol of authority, if not simply leadership. Like, think Psalm 23, the rod was used to guide and correct sheep. Think in Exodus chapter 40 and however long ago it was that we went through that. Moses' rod, his staff, became known as the rod of God. Well, And throughout Exodus and here into the book of Numbers, and we'll see it in a couple weeks, his staff, his rod, was used to perform various miracles, or the Lord worked through that. Various other psalms, Psalm 2, Psalm 89, for example, different chapters in Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 10, Isaiah chapter 11, into Ezekiel, Ezekiel chapter 20. The rod provides a picture of God's authority over man. Like, think of this term, you've heard this countless times in your Bible study, rod of iron. It's a symbol of authority, like kind of think of a scepter at that point. And each of these leaders here in chapter 17 had one of these. And God here seems to be bringing further clarity into their complaints and accusations in the previous chapters, specifically against Aaron. So write their names on them and place them in the tabernacle. And then, verse 5, it shall be that the rod of the man whom I choose will blossom. Then I will rid myself of the complaints of the children of Israel, which they make against you. So Moses spoke to the children of Israel, and each of their leaders gave him a rod apiece, for each leader according to their father's houses, 12 rods, and the rod of Aaron was among the rods. And Moses placed the rods before the Lord in the tabernacle of witness. Now it came to pass, verse 8, on the next day that Moses went into the tabernacle of witness, and behold, the rod of Aaron, of the house of Levi, had sprouted and put forth buds, had produced blossoms, and yielded ripe almonds. Like, I wonder if even Moses is kind of blown away by this type of a miracle. This is extraordinary. It's one of those that you don't really think about, but it's a pretty extraordinary miracle. It's like the Jesus' first miracle at the wedding, John chapter 2, water to wine. What's involved in that? Fermentation. And what is the one main requirement for fermentation? Time. In a moment, it's wine. And you remember the master of the feast? Time. Just stopped? Didn't. He just skipped time for that miracle. This here is extraordinary because it's obviously a miracle. This is a staff. It's a branch. It's just a lifeless piece of wood, and it becomes alive to produce not just like branches springing forth from it, but it's fruitful. It budded. Not simply Aaron's in charge and that's final. Look, there's a couple branches, but no, this is life-giving, fruitful leadership from this priest. I'm recognizing him in that capacity. That's the idea here. So Moses brought out all the rods from before the Lord, verse 9, to all the children of Israel, and they looked, and each man took his rod. They put their names on them, right? And the Lord said to Moses, bring Aaron's rod back before the testimony to be kept as a sign against the rebels, that they may put their complaints away from me, lest they die. Like, if we ever need to reference that at another time, let's just have that handy because, oh, I don't know, the rebels might appear yet again. Thus did Moses, just as the Lord had commanded him, so he did. So the children of Israel spoke to Moses, saying, surely we die. We perish. We all perish. Like, we're going to get it. They knew they deserved it. And whoever comes near the tabernacle of the Lord must die. Shall we all utterly die? Obviously, we know that the complaints didn't, of course, disappear entirely after this. But God's displeasure with them became more obvious. Or his displeasure against their complaints became more obvious. Like, here's this item to mark this moment that everyone can say, oh yeah, that's right, the Lord's not too pleased with this. And that's why the people are saying that we die. They recognize the Lord's displeasure. It also didn't mean that Aaron would never fail, but this was just signifying that yes, indeed, yet again, Moses and Aaron, specifically Aaron for this role, this was God's man for that role for that season. Last thing, and this is just me giving some commentary on these couple chapters, including like over into chapter 16, and just keep rolling forward with this throughout their history, this whole concept of complaining. Obviously, in Philippians chapter 2 and verse 14, do all things without complaining and disputing. That can be translated grumbling and arguing. I don't know about you, but I'm pretty good at both of those things. And so when it says do all things without those, it's like, how about just a few? Can I do a few things? Like, do all those things, everything without it. As each of these other men received their rods, they would have seen God's answer. It was to be Aaron and not them who had this calling. It wasn't Korah. It wasn't any of those other 250. None of them were called to that. They had to recognize this is Aaron and this is what the Lord's doing. They needed to accept God's will for all of it and His will for their own lives as well. I think we all know this. It's not like a churchy kind of a thing. It just happens in the church as well, but complaining is like a cancer. But it's like worse than a cancer. You're like, well, how could anything be worse than a cancer? It's worse than a cancer because it's like a contagious type of a cancer. Like once it starts, those little roots get in, they just attach to other people, and man, you see it where things are going pretty good, and that one little, do you know what Aaron's doing right now? Man, Moses, he's sure taking a lot on himself. Well, I never thought of that. We're all pretty holy, aren't we? Isn't it weird that they act like they're the only ones holy? Oh, I never thought of that. Thank you for bringing that to my attention, right? And everything is pretty happy, and then all of a sudden it's not. And it ruins relationships. I mean, even again, in Christian or secular levels, it wrecks workplaces. It certainly kills the culture of a church. It mortifies morale. People are in pretty good spirits now. It doesn't provide clarity. It breeds contempt and confusion. And far from being admirable, it's rooted in accusations. The whole of the beginning of chapter 16 is them just accusing Moses and Aaron of trying to do this for themselves. Again, ironically, that's exactly what Korah and his ilk were doing. It just seemed like, we need to fix this because everybody's holy. We're going to do this for the Lord. They weren't doing it for the Lord. One more David Guzik here, and I promise I'll wrap this up in just a moment. Murmurers, complainers, are rarely satisfied by evidence or the resolution of an issue. Complainers are not issue motivated, though they claim to be and appear to be. They are heart motivated. They murmur because they have complaining, discontent hearts. The complaining heart is demonstrated when people murmur about one issue after another, never being satisfied. Like if it's just one issue, can we just figure out what's happening here? Okay, good, everything's fine. But it's like, and then the next issue, and usually it's this. And again, church or otherwise, it's just worse when we're a family. It's things that actually are not issues become issues, even though they're still not issues. That's the whole discussion in verses 1, 2, and 3 of chapter 16. You take too much on it, etc. This wasn't an issue. They defined and designed a non-issue and made it something that affected everyone. And that's just largely in the realm of interpersonal relationships, but I think we can kind of shift it a little bit to our own hearts. When we complain against the Lord, or let's say it this way, when we're complaining about what the Lord has brought into our lives or what we think that He has not brought into our lives, we are complaining against Him. I'm going to say a pretty dramatic statement here, but I think it's right. It's a not-so-subtle form of blasphemy. Whoa, what? Really? It's a not-so-subtle form of blasphemy. It's us ever so gently stating that He must have gotten something wrong. This is what's happened in my life. I'm not complaining. I'm just saying what it is. We're good at that too. Like redefining our complaining. We don't say it exactly, but what we're thinking, maybe we're not even thinking it, but this is what it is. If I were God, that's not how I would have done it, right? Or I would have not allowed that to happen. It's kind of a fairly coy admission of a lack of trust in God and trust in the character of God. Why would you do this, God? Might very well be both us saying that He apparently doesn't know what is best, and it's also us saying that we know better than He knows. Didn't think of it that way. We're suggesting that He doesn't know best, or He simply doesn't know at all, or He doesn't know what to do in my life in this situation, or He simply doesn't care to do what's right. God, why would you allow this? In the Psalms, you'll actually find David pouring out his complaint to the Lord. If you have one, I strongly recommend you bring it to the Lord rather than about the Lord. It's not like he's like, oh, they were complaining? I never knew that. Like all these instances in these chapters, and like, and then the glory of the Lord was like, they're just talking to Moses and like, oops, kind of forgot that the Lord could hear all of this. Oh yeah, he kind of can. Just be careful with these things. Again, it's not just church per se, it's everything. And it's in our own hearts, our own lives, our own minds. Be careful. Your silly statement for me for tonight is this: let's just let God be God. God's actually better at being God than you or I are at being God. Yeah, but my life right now, he's still God. And oh, by the way, things in life right now are actually wonderful reminders that we're still on this side of eternity. Like when everything's just flowers and lollipops all day, every day, you'd actually have to start to wonder, well, then why do we need heaven? He allows these things. He's still God. He's still good. He's still good at what he does. Let's just submit to him without complaint. And in fact, when we're prone to complain, maybe a heart of gratitude, a mind of gratitude, would be better served. Lord, thank you for your word, and thank you for these humbling reminders. This is rough stuff, but at the same time, it's so good, it's so healthy, because it exposes our own hearts and minds. It exposes the tactics of the enemy, too. And we need to be aware of that. We need to understand how he works. And unfortunately, we need to understand how those things are at work in our own hearts and minds. And so may we be quick to submit to you. When we find ourselves complaining, grumbling, murmuring, may we recognize that at the end of the day, oh, it's very much most likely against you, if not full on against you. May we rather just submit and say, Lord, thank you that you know what you're doing, and your way is always going to be better than anything we could imagine for ourselves. So we submit to you. Thank you again for your word. Thank you that we can gather in Jesus' name. Amen. Thanks for coming, everybody. See you Sunday.